They're trying to get unfettered access to some sort of technology, some sort of environment, some sort of data. How do they get unfettered access? Through an identity that isn't secured correctly.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to an Identity Breach Confidential edition of the HIP Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Duby, Principal Technologist Americas for Semperis. Identity Breach Confidential takes listeners inside the high-stakes world of cybersecurity incident response, focusing on the real stories and tense negotiations that happen during major cyber attacks. My co-host for IBC episodes is Jeff Wickman, Semperis' Director of Incident Response, also known as the Negotiator, and a veteran in digital forensics and ransomware negotiation. So CISOs come in all shapes and sizes. But my enduring stereotype, and I've met quite a few, my enduring stereotype of the role has been a guy in his 40s or 50s with a shaved head and a full bushy beard, sometimes with coloring. Our guest today is not that stereotype. Krista Iron is the Associate CISO at St. Luke's University Health Network, where she's responsible for managing the security program's day-to-day operational effectiveness. In her previous roles, Krista assisted with developing and leading security programs in crypto, finance, and the Department of Defense. Krista earned her bachelor's degree in biology from Felician College in New Jersey, where she was a scholarship athlete, serving as the women's basketball team captain. She also holds her CISM and CRISC certifications and NHRA competition driver's license. And I'll bet that you've not heard the acronym NHRA around cybersecurity before, but we'll ask a little bit about that. She's also a published author, detailing her journey to embracing her unique authenticity in her book, Permission to Be Real, How to Lead, Influence, and Thrive Without Fitting the Mold. Throughout this service and her writing, Krista's mission is to give back to her community by providing mentorship and support for aspiring cybersecurity professionals, especially for women who wish to enter the field. When off the clock, Krista takes her affinity for overcoming challenges to the garage and the racetrack, where she enjoys building and improving her own race car, which I might add looks a lot like my daily driver, but is completely different under the skin, competing as a driver in national drag racing events with her family and using her racing as a forum to advocate for neurodiversity awareness and inclusion. You can see a fascinating clip with Krista and her racing as part of a Midnight in the War Room series on YouTube. Welcome, Krista.
Hey, guys. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've had an unusual path to the CISO role with basketball and a biology major as groundwork. How did you make your way to information security in general and to a security officer in particular? What drew you to it?
I don't know. Someone drew the short straw and I guess had to hire me. I'm not sure. They were down a body or six and were like, oh, it's like, you ever see that the commercial back in the day where you're like, oh, give it to Timmy, he'll eat anything. Oh, like, you know, Crystal, take any opportunity, give it to her. And I'll tell you, they weren't wrong. And I think that's really where or how, if you were to sum it up, how I got to where I am today. Bio degree, I was going to be a nurse. So always mission driven, just trying to find a path that made sense. And that made me feel, I mean, because it's two sided, right? Like I want to do good things, but I want to feel satisfaction as well. So they benefit, I kind of benefit like finding my life purpose. But I didn't get into the accelerated nursing program I wanted to. So I kind of went out into the working world. My brain never stops and it's a blessing and a curse. And then I got into a bunch of contracts in the Department of Defense. I started in process improvement because of my analytic background, right? STEM, we talk about it all the time. And I want to say that I kind of took opportunities as they presented themselves. And I fell into some IT and security contracts as a program manager and risk manager because no one else wanted it. They were small and would never grow. And guess what? I doubled them in like a year. So like to prove people wrong too. And then I got an opportunity at a bank up here in Pennsylvania to move back closer to my family, worked my butt off, worked my way up, and got the deputy CISO role because I was always interested in business, and then got recruited into crypto to help build a cybersecurity program for a startup. Then they went into Chapter 11. No joke, crypto has been rough the last, 5 to 10 years. And got an opportunity, a cold application for a CISO to consolidate 12 national orthopedic programs into one overarching thing. So if you've ever taken a bunch of random stuff and tried to make a discernible project out of it, I'll say like race cars, right? Oh, I need to build something fast. Like what do I got in the garage? Let's use some zip ties and some duct tape and whatever we can find and fabricate. My husband's really good at that. But yeah, so I had that opportunity. I learned a lot about healthcare. So now finance helped our healthcare crypto DoD. And here I am today. I got an opportunity. St. Luke's was hiring for a new ACISO position. And I heard really good things about the CISO here. Phenomenal. And I got the opportunity. And through, now I'm going to say networking and qualification as well. So that'll tell you. Networking does leaps and bounds for your career. And now here I am today trying to innovate in healthcare, and the program's great. So it's a really good platform to do it.
I hear a subtitle for your book, Building Programs Out of Zip Ties and Duct Tape.
So you guys are going to help me write another one, right? Because that's a fascinating take on it.
Right. Exactly. Well, yeah, go with what you have on hand. So tell us about your book. Your book, this came out, I believe, last year, right? Permission to Be Real. What yep. inspired you to write it on top of, obviously, you've got nothing else going on in your life?
I had a moment of inspiration and boredom that kind of clashed at the same time, and it gave me an awe moment. And you know how the strangest combinations of things will motivate you to do something that you would be like, oh, I might try to tackle that 5 years from now, and 5 years becomes today. So there had been a lot of conversations and my thought process around, like, through my entire career, I never quite felt like, you joked about it in the beginning, I never fit that mold of what you typically are used to, right? The societal norm of what a security leader or someone would look like. And for me, coming from the Department of Defense and Finance, who are very white collar in the sense of like kind of societal norms, it was always someone in a suit, well cut, well articulated, well kept, and was very good at communicating their thoughts and communicating with others and building relationships. And for me, I have always kind of struggled in, I'll dress up when I have to, and I will do my hair and my makeup when I have to, and absolutely I know when to articulate and be corporate. But also, I think what we're dealing with in cyber is too much of that expectation. And a lot of the talent that we have that I've kind of identified through just, I love observing people. The talent is very diverse, and that's what makes us successful. And I was like, hey, everybody's touting diversity, but like, what does that really mean? And then I had this epiphany one day, and I'm like, yeah, diversity is literally not, people thinking differently, but their experiences, their backgrounds, embracing all of that, embracing their day-to-day, lifestyle and things like that. And that also contributes really heavily to how someone thinks. And so why would you try to expect that someone's going to think differently and try to stifle the inputs that have helped them get to that point to be successfully diverse? And so I just had this dumb moment and decided now was the time to write, and started putting my thoughts down. And I was like, oh, I'm never gonna finish this. And then this is a funny story, because we all have them, or at least half of us have them. I was talking to my therapist one day, and he's like, oh, you wrote a book? I was like, yeah, I don't know, I just kind of felt like it. There's no like fun backstory behind it. And he's like, okay. And he's like, what are you gonna do with it? I'm like, probably nothing. I'm probably gonna read it a couple of years from now. And it'll be a good look back on my life and say, okay, it'll help me improve, or it'll help me, look back on what I've accomplished to try to find a path, because I still struggle. I am a very mission-driven person, and I struggle with making sure that I am feeling like I'm doing enough to serve other people's missions and not just my own, right? And so I took that kind of internalized it. I was like, yeah, why don't I do something? What's the worst that could happen? Someone writes a horrific view on Amazon and is like, oh, I read this book. It sucks. And I'll be like, okay, cool. But I tried, right? Sometimes it's great to try something new and be able to suck at it. So I took the chance with my family's support and released it on KDP. And, you know, talking about never having time, I also learned how to self-edit, how to review for legal implications, plagiarism, all that fun stuff that no one ever wants to learn, but is very interesting once you know it. And here we are today. Now it's out there and it's doing pretty well.
That's awesome. How long did it take to write that?
I want to say about 3 months of working after hours, after work. So we would watch TV together. Yeah. Look, when I get on a soapbox, you ever hyperfixate on something and you're like, oh, I gotta do it.
I don't know if I've ever been able to or even think I could write a book in 3 months, but kudos. That's impressive.
Look, it's 160 some pages. So, you know, I'm not trying to write a Shakespearean like novel or, you know,
it's not a tech
Charles
manual.
Dickens. Yeah.
That's awesome. When you were considering writing the book, and I gotta say I'm fascinated with your career path, and I'm probably gonna go pick up the book myself now. What you were saying about being able to communicate and the diversity, I think that's something that a lot of people kind of overlook, because in my experience, when I was negotiating on behalf of a company, I was talking with the CISOs, then I had to translate differently to the tech people who they had a very different mission than what the CISO had, but they had to align. Yeah. And I think that's a pretty big piece that, you know, early in the career, I never thought of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so that's an interesting point though. So, you know, I'll take the Super Bowl in because we just watched it in the halftime show. And, you know, he was able to express himself using a different language through movement and pictures and, you know, the whole setup that he did so you can understand the journey that he was trying to articulate there. So, I mean, for us, we don't think of, you know, IT or security as a different language, but, you know, I kind of liken it to that because if it's like going to a doctor's office and getting a diagnosis and you're like, I'm sorry, like I'm an intelligent person, but what did you just say? And so, you know, being multilingual is speaking other people's, you know, lingo. It's like, you know, connecting with HR or connecting with a physician as to why they have to or can't do something. You really have to meet people. When you hear like meet people where they are, it isn't like in person anymore. I mean, sometimes that goes like, but I think about all these things and it's really meeting them cognitively where they are and trying to figure out like where they come from, you know, what terms they speak in and those types of things. So yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. So your background, obviously it's super interesting. Have you ever been involved in a cyber incident?
Oh my God. Yeah. I hate to even say it. Number one, no. Like, can we backtrack that? You said my background is interesting. I get it's nonlinear. And it, like, I hear that a lot. And I'm like, oh, you know, I was a risk analyst and like I audited. And so like, I just, no offense, auditors, like we have our place and I am a GRC nerd, but I never, oh my God, like this is the most interesting thing. And I'm like, if I find people like that, you're my tribe.
Fair.
Because there's, you never hear that.
No one ever says that.
Fair enough. From that identity incident response perspective or incident that you may have gone through, do you have any stories that you could share with us on maybe a lesson learned from it, what the root cause was? Obviously, trying to keep everything in the right place where we don't share customer information or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's really important. So I'm glad you guys touched on that. In the incidents that I've been involved in, major or not, I'll tell you, identity is at the crux of that, right? Or the core of, you know, they could exploit vulnerabilities, but truly, what does that lead to? They're trying to get unfettered access to some sort of technology, some sort of environment, some sort of data. How do they get unfettered access? Through an identity that isn't secured correctly or, you know, has too many hands in the pot or too many owners or, you know, credentials are shared. And I'll tell you that multi-factor, basic MFA, even internally in your environment, is something that I mean, it doesn't even have to be passwordless at this point. Not having MFA and still having that kind of like, oh, you're inside my proverbial network, even though there's no like real network unless you're old school anymore. So we trust you to go to something else. Like that can't happen anymore. You still have to validate those identities. And so identity is always the one. And then what they do, no matter what the ingress is, which Teams is really common now, not message, because you can lock that down. It's a phone call. They call them and then, oh yeah, I see you have an issue. And they bypass, let the user authenticate and they're totally in. And then the user sends them a data dump and then they get access. And you know, what if there was a way to validate that person in the IT help desk's identity? Conversely, right? Like they validate ours when we call in for password relief resets. How do we validate theirs?
Yeah, that's a great point. Like you said, it's the crux. Every case that I've ever been involved in, even if it's a 0 day compromise, typically they get access to a specific system or an application. And then what do they do next? Look for an identity to take. And it's unfortunate, but it's the state we live in.
Yeah, and think about it. So think about like I know you guys have a ton to talk about. Like now I'm on a soapbox. Think about AI and the agentics. Like, what are you really worried about? Like, okay, yeah, securing those basic, they're like non-humans, right? They're kind of like service accounts, but with potentially unfettered access because you allow them the autonomy to make decisions. You're not securing them contextually. You don't understand if they it's like the communication thing, right? The gap. You don't understand if like what they understand is exactly the way you understand it. And then we're losing data that way too. It's like
Yeah,
so
if you
many,
look
it's such a rabbit hole.
it is, it is. And I was playing with Moltbot just the other day, and it continually learns as you give it more data. And if it has access, it's just like one of those things where I kind of just, stepped back and was like, why is this a good idea? Granted, it can develop things for us and make things better, but you have to give it unfettered access. And that, to me, is just, it's a no-brainer from an incident response perspective. You're just damning yourself if you do. So I've got another question for you. You're big into drag racing. That was one of those pieces I was like very intrigued with. Give me your story of drag racing compared to incident response and the engagements that you have gone through or the incidents that you've gone through. How does it compare?
No matter how much you practice, I mean, practice definitely helps, right? Like we have tabletop exercises, red team, blue team, like whatever you want to call it, with the business people, with the IT people. You never, unless you are someone who responds well, when in the midst of the heat of an occurrence, like something that a high stressor out of the blue. You're going to make mistakes. And I'll give you an example. I tell this story a lot thanks to my friend Cam, who works over at Secure World. He actually helped me to have the confidence to tell this story because it was a big life-changing event. In 2015, I had a huge accident. And that was my rookie year, drag racing nationally, like a full series. And so the car was awesome, like really, really well built. And who knows what happened? I mean, I know what we think happened, but ultimately, I had no brakes at the end of the track, and I went into the retaining net at the end, and it annihilated the car, and I got lucky to walk away the way I did. But you have fail safes in a car, right? So you want to talk about comparison in an incident, like number one. I could have panicked and it could have gone a lot worse at those speeds. So I think I was about like 130 at the time, 135, I forget. I mean, it was so long ago. But at those speeds, you have to make quick decisions. And I'll plug my husband actually runs like 690s or something in his class in the quarter right now, which is insanity. And so even at those speeds, you can hurt yourself, you can hurt other people that are next to you. And how you respond when the car gets, even if you feel a little it getting a little bit squirrely or out of sorts where it's not having a clean pass or, it stands up because, it does a wheelie or something like that, even though you don't want it to, like you want it to glide very, I know it looks good, but it's not what you want
Looks
because it slows
cool.
you down. Yeah, it looks fucking awesome. And I guess in that instance, you have to really know through experience how to respond and to stay calm. And While I didn't do the wrong thing, I was kind of young in my career in racing, and I learned a lot from that, right? Like, I continued to hold on to the steering wheel. And theoretically, you're not supposed to do that because you can like break your wrists if you impact really hard. I got lucky. You're supposed to actually take your arms and cross them and take them off the wheel. But geez, so I didn't have a parachute because of the class requirements from a safety perspective. But, if I wasn't buckled in my harness or, for whatever reason, I cheaped out on safety gear, and we see this all the time. Or if I downshifted or, dirked the wheel the wrong way, it could have gone much worse. So did I lose a car? Absolutely. Did I, have a significant impact to life? No. Other than, a lot of reflection. But it's the same thing. Like, you can practice, practice, practice. You're never going to be perfect. You have to really stay calm, in the moment. And I think probably one of the most interesting things thinking about it, that I'm going to thank Sim Paris for, because I learned this at the recent HIP event last year, is the psychology of how people interact, and especially in this instance with technology. So how can you incorporate some sort of, calming mechanisms or psychological exercises to keep yourself calm and in a state of potential panic when all crap breaks loose? Trying to keep my mouth clean on this one.
You already failed that a couple minutes ago, just so you know. That's
Well, actually,
awesome.
it's interesting that you mentioned that. So you're talking about Dr. Mary Akin at HIP, probably. So I interviewed her for this podcast separately. So I have a podcast interview with her that just launched. But we sort of really dug into some of those topics that you're talking about.
Awesome.
Actually, I'm curious, and you mentioned, we talk about you're a professional risk manager, and obviously risk is all over the place in drag racing. So, but it's always risk versus reward. So what is it that you love so much about drag racing that causes you to embrace that risk?
The challenge. I have to keep my mind busy. I'm a competitive person, by nature. And for me, the challenge isn't just winning. It's being able to improve my skills, stay calm, learn new things. So I think collectively, what is the risk? Yes, absolutely. You could hurt yourself, you could hurt someone else. Losing your belongings, so destroying your race car, so financial risk there. But at the same time, I think about it, is the risk greater of what I do with drag racing, or the risk of making incorrect decisions or responding incorrectly if there's an incident and it affecting patient lives? So I try to put things into perspective, and I almost use that comparatively. As you've seen, like, my book goes a lot into it, comparing drag racing with authenticity and kind of tips and tricks, and my experiences. But I use each to help me better myself in each part of my life is the best way. So I don't know. It started out because I loved the challenge. And I think the challenge has morphed over the years from just trying to win a race to appreciating the little wins and losses, and figuring out how to innovate or to overcome.
Very
Yeah, so
cool.
you're always looking for ways to learn and to improve, and challenges as part of that path.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you would hope,
Okay.
right? There are some people who are like, I think I've innovated enough. I'm good where I am. And that's fine.
Well, let me ask you maybe a last question, Krista, is, a lot of this revolves around personality, and we just sort of talked a little bit about that. How much do you think, in the CISO role, you're around, been around a number of CISOs, as have Jeff and I. What kind of traits, personality traits specifically, that are required to survive and flourish in a high-pressure role like information security, where the tenure is short, you may not have control over everything, but you get blamed for everything. I mean, it's got to be like one of the toughest, if not the toughest role in IT.
It's interesting, and I try to, give justice to both sides. Like, there are definitely jobs in the world that are much harder than what I do. We deal with a lot, I think. And so it's the diversity and the unknown of everything we have to try to defend against. It's like, oh, I'm gonna you know, I know someone's going to come at me with some sort of weapon, but I'm blindfolded. I can't hear anything. Or I hear just a little bit of muffle. And, you know, I have to successfully defend against that, successfully respond against that. And that's how I really feel. So I'll tell you what I think are good traits to have is emotional control and patience. So emotional control, I don't just, you know, call out, you know, being excited or having a lot of energy, things like that. Emotional control spans, like, you have to understand how to adapt to your situations. And I read something interesting, which is totally true. A lot of us, and this will put it in context, might feel burnout at the end of the day, especially in security leadership. And your question is like, why? You know, I know the back-to-back meetings, but I don't always have those all days. So what else can lead us to that? And ultimately, it's the emotional control of being a leader, right? So, and this is where it comes back to physiology and psychology. Our bodies were kind of built to respond to our emotions and our physiological triggers. And this is where my science background comes in, which is we're all nerding right now. But in our situations, we have to stay calm. We have to adapt, right? So our bodies, we're not allowed to scream on a bad day or get really mad. We have to control those emotions and understand what is the best way to respond in that situation to help, you know, from a risk management perspective, right? To help the organization, to help your team, to meet or achieve that goal that you're trying to achieve. And so I think everything, so the emotional control also comes down to, you know when you can have fun and breathe and being serious all the time. Like, look, I run a tight ship in a sense, but I think part of our success is my leader and I letting everybody know that it's okay to be themselves and to chatter and to send stupid memes back and forth and, you know, get together and just randomly talk about stuff that's non-work related. Because emotional control, like, you need an outlet for that.
Right.
100%.
Makes sense. That makes sense. Well, thank you, Krista. Thank you for your time. As we know, you're a very busy person at both in work and at home. And I would encourage everybody that's listened to this and is at all intrigued, number one, check out her book. And number two, go look at you. It's on YouTube and Instagram, her clip in Midnight in the War Room, where she gets to talk about, in a little more detail about that. I'll call it exciting incident that she fortunately walked away from. Just very cool. So for Separus, myself, and for Jeff, thanks for spending time with us. And I expect I'll see you in Black Hat.
I was just going to say, see you guys there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, where Men in the War Room will be premiering, which is also very cool. Thank you. Absolutely.
Thanks for
thank you both. All right.